Audio Renaissance presents Lean Mean 13 by Janet Ivanovich. Read for you by Lorelei King. Chapter 1. For the last 5 minutes, I've been parked outside my cousin Vinny's bail bonds office in my crapola car, debating whether to continue on with my day or return to my apartment and crawl back into bed. My name is Stephanie Plum, and sensible Stephanie wanted to go back to bed. Loco Stephanie was thinking she should get on with it. I was about to do something I knew I shouldn't do. The signs were all there in front of me. Sick stomach, feeling of impending disaster, knowledge that it was illegal, and yet I was going to forge ahead with the plan. Not that this was especially unusual. Truth is, I've been dealing with impending doom for as long as I can remember. Heck, when I was 6 years old, I sprinkled sugar on my head, convinced myself it was pixie dust, wished myself invisible, and walked into the boys' bathroom at school. I mean, you don't know the water's over your head until you jump in, right? The door to the bonds office opened, and Lula stuck her head out and yelled at me. Are you gonna sit there all day or what? Lula is a black woman with a Rubenesque body and a Vegas wardrobe that's 4 sizes too small. She's a former hoe, currently working as a file clerk for the office and a wheelman for me, when the mood strikes. Today she was wearing big fake fur Sasquatch boots, and her ass was packed into poison green spandex pants. Her pink sweatshirt had Love Goddess spelled out in sequins across her boobs. My wardrobe runs a lot more casual than Lula's. I was wearing jeans and a long-sleeve knit shirt from The Gap. My feet were stuffed into knockoff UGG boots, and I was bundled into a big quilted jacket. I have naturally curly brown hair that looks okay when I wear it shoulder length. When it's short, the best you can say is that it has energy. I'd swiped on some extra mascara today, hoping to boost my bravado. I had a favor to perform that I suspected was going to come back to haunt me. I grabbed my bag, wrenched the driver's side door open, and angled myself out of the car. It was the end of February, and there was gloom as far as the eye could see. It was almost 10 a.m., but the streetlights were on, and visibility in the swirling snow was about 6 inches. A truck chugged past, throwing slush halfway up my leg, soaking my jeans, bringing out my trash mouth. Winter Wonderland, Jersey style. Connie Rizzoli looked around her computer at me when I walked into the office. Connie is Vinny's office manager and his first line of defense against a stream of pissed-off bondees, bookies, hookers, various bill collectors, and stiffed smut peddlers hoping to reach Vinny's inner sanctum. Connie was a couple years older than me, a couple pounds heavier, a couple inches shorter, a couple cups bigger, and had hair a couple inches higher than mine. Connie was pretty in a kick-ass Central Jersey third-generation Italian kind of way.
I have 3 new skips, Connie said. One of them is Simon Diggory again.
Skips are people who fail to show for a court appearance after Vinny has bonded them out of jail. Vinny loses money when bondees fail to appear, so that's where I come in. I work for Vinny as a fugitive apprehension agent, better known as bounty hunter, and my job is to find the skips and drag them back into the system.
Don't look to me to help you out with Simon Diggory, Lula said, plunking herself down on the brown Naugahyde couch, picking up her copy of Star magazine. Been there, done that. Not doing it again. No way.
He's an easy catch, I said. We know exactly where to find him.
There's no we gonna happen. You're on your own. I'm not freezing my sweet Jesus sitting in some bone orchard in the dead of night waiting for Simon Diggory to show up.
Diggory was, among other things, a professional grave robber, relieving the recently deceased of rings, watches, and the occasional Brooks Brothers suit, if it was Diggory's size. Last time Diggory was in violation of his bond, Lula and I caught him hacksawing a cocktail ring off Miriam Lukacs. We chased him all over the cemetery before I tackled him in front of the crematorium. I took the 3 new files from Connie and shoved them into my shoulder bag. I'm off.
Where you going? Lula wanted to know. It's almost lunchtime. I don't suppose you're going to be passing by someplace I could get a meatball sub. I could use a meatball sub on a nasty day like this.
I'm going downtown, I told her. I need to talk to Dickie.
Say what?
Lula was up on her feet.
Did I hear you right? Is this a Dickie that called the police on you last time you were in his office? Is this a Dickie you told to go fuck himself? Is this a Dickie you were married to for 15 minutes in another life?
Yep, that's the Dickie. Lula grabbed her coat and scarf from the chair.
I'll ride with you. I gotta see this. Hell, I don't even care about the meatball sub anymore. Okay, but we're not making a scene, I said to Lula. I need to talk to Dickie about a legal issue. This is going to be non-confrontational.
I know that. Non-confrontational, like two civilized people.
Hold on, I'm going too, Connie said, getting her purse from her bottom desk drawer.
I don't want to miss this. I'll close the office for a couple hours for this one.
I'm not making a scene, I told her.
Sure, but I'm packing, just in case it gets ugly, Connie said.
Me too, Lula said. It isn't diamonds that's a girl's best friend. It's a 9mm Glock.
Connie and Lula looked at me.
What are you carrying? Connie asked.
A brand new can of hairspray and this lip gloss I've got on.
It's a pretty good lip gloss, Lula said, but it wouldn't hurt to have a piece as a backup.
Connie stuffed herself into her coat.
I can't imagine what legal problem you'd want to discuss with Dickie, but it must be a bitch to get you out in this weather.
It's sort of personal, I said, relying on the one really decent bounty hunter skill I possessed, the ability to fib. It dates back to when we were married. It has to do with taxes. We all went head down into the cold. Connie locked the office door, and we got into Lula's red Firebird. Lula cranked the engine over, hip-hop blasted out of the CD player, and Lula motored off.
Is Dickie still downtown? Lula wanted to know.
Yes, but he's in a new office, 3240 Bryan Place. His firm is Pediak, Smullen, Gorvitch, and Orr.
Lula cruised down Hamilton and turned onto North Broad. The wind had cut back, and it was no longer snowing, but there was still a thick cloud cover overhead. At best, the weather could now be described as grim. I was silently rehearsing my fake speech about how I needed information for an audit, and I was making promises to myself as performance incentive. I was seeing macaroni and cheese in my near future, butterscotch tasty cakes, onion rings, Snickers bars. Okay, so this had all the makings of a clusterfuck, but there was a Dairy Queen Oreo Cheesequake blizzard waiting for me somewhere.
Lula took a left at Bryan and found a parking space half a block from Dickie's office building.
I'm gonna smack you on the head if you don't stop cracking your knuckles, Lula said to me. You gotta chill. You need some tax information and he's gotta give it to you.
Lula cut her eyes to me.
That's all there is to it, right?
Pretty much.
Uh-oh, Lula said. There's more, isn't there?
We all got out of the Firebird and stood huddled against the cold. Actually, I have to plant a couple bugs on him for Ranger, I told Lula. There it was, out in the open, swinging in the breeze. The favor from hell. Carlos Manoso goes by the street name Ranger. He's my friend, my bounty hunter mentor, and in this case, my partner in crime. He's Cuban-American with dark skin and dark eyes and dark brown hair recently cut short. He's half a head taller than I am and 2 months older. I've seen him naked, and when I say every part of him is perfect, you can take it to the bank. He was Special Forces, and while he's no longer military, he's still got the skills and the muscle. He owns a security company named Rangeman now. Plus, he does the high bond skips for Vinny. He's a hot guy, and there are strong feelings between us, but I try to keep some distance. Ranger plays by his own set of rules, and I don't have a complete copy.
I knew it, Lula said. I knew this would be good.
You need something better than taxes, Connie said. You're gonna need a diversion if you want to plant bugs.
Yeah, Lula said. You need us to go along with you. You need some hustle and bustle.
How about if we say we want to start a business together, Connie said, and we need advice on permits and partnership agreements.
What kind of business we got? Lula asked. I gotta know what I'm getting into with you.
It's not a real business, Connie said. We're just pretending.
I still gotta know, Lula said. I'm not putting my good name on just any old thing.
For Christ's sake, Connie said, flapping her arms and stamping her feet to keep warm. It could be anything. We could cater parties.
Yeah, that's believable, Lula said, on account of we're all such gourmet cooks. The only time I turn my oven on is to heat up my apartment, and Stephanie probably don't even know where her oven is.
Okay, how about a dry cleaner, or chauffeured limos, or dog walking, or we could buy a shrimp boat?
I like the limo idea, Lula said. We could buy a Lincoln and dress up in badass uniforms, some with some bling.
It's okay with me, Connie said.
I nodded and pulled my scarf up over my nose.
Me too. Let's go inside. I'm freezing.
Wait, Lula said. We need a name. You can't have a limo company without a name.
Lucky Limos, Connie said.
The hell, Lula said. I'm not joining up with a limo company that's got a lame name like that.
Then you name it, Connie said to Lula. I don't give a fig what the friggin' company is called. My feet are numb.
It should be something that reflects on us, Lula said. Like the Bitches Limos.
That's a stupid name. No one's gonna hire a limo from a company with a name like that, Connie said.
I know some people, Lula said.
Lovely limos, lonely limos, loser limos, lumpy limos, loony limos, la-di-da limos, limos for liars, lampshade limos, landfill limos, leaky limos, lemon limos, long limos, large limos, lazy limos, loosey-goosey limos, I said.
Connie looked at me and grimaced. Maybe it should be called Lula's Limos, I said.
Yeah, that got a ring to it, Lula said.
Then it's a deal, Lula's Limos.
Deal, Connie said.
Get out of my way so I can get inside and defrost.
We all pushed through the front door to Dickie's building and stood in the foyer, sopping up the sudden blast of heat. The foyer opened to a reception area, and I was relieved to see an unfamiliar face behind the desk. If anyone had recognized me from my last visit, they would have immediately called for security.
Let me do the talking, I said to Lula.
Sure, Lula said. I'll be quiet as a mouse. I'll zip my lip.
I approached the desk and made an attempt at demure. We'd like to see Mr. Orr, I told the woman.
Do you have an appointment?
No, I said. I'm terribly sorry to drop in like this, but we're starting a new business and we need some legal advice. We were down the street looking at real estate and thought we'd take a chance that Mr. Orr might have a moment for us.
Of course, the woman said. Let me see if he's available. The name?
Capital City Limo.
Huh, Lula said behind me.
The woman buzzed Dickie and relayed our information. She got off the phone and smiled.
He has a few minutes between appointments. You can take the elevator to your left, second floor.
We all moved into the elevator and I pushed the button for the second floor.
What was that? Lula wanted to know. Capital City Limo?
It just popped out, but it sounds classy, right?
Not as classy as Lula's limos, Lula said. I call Lula's limos any day of the week over Capital City Limos. Capital City Limo sounds like it's got a stick up its ass, but you'd be in for a good time in Lula's limo.
The door opened and we spilled out of the elevator into another reception room with another new face at the desk.
Mr. Orr is expecting you, the woman said. His office is at the end of the corridor.
I led the parade in a sedate march to Dickie's office. I got to his open door and rapped lightly. I peeked in and smiled, friendly, non-threatening. Dickie looked up and gasped. He'd put on a few pounds since the last time I saw him. His brown hair was thinning at the top, and he was wearing glasses. He was dressed in a white shirt, red and blue striped tie, and a dark blue suit. I thought he was handsome when I married him, and he was still a nice-looking guy in a corporate sort of way. But he felt soft compared to Joe Morelli and Ranger, the two men who were currently in my life. Dickie lacked the heat and raw male energy that surrounded Morelli and Ranger. And of course, I now knew Dickie was an asshole.
No need for alarm, I said calmly. I'm here as a client. I needed a lawyer, and I thought of you.
Lucky me, Dickie said.
I felt my eyes involuntarily narrow and did some mental deep breathing.
Lula and Connie and I are thinking about starting a limo service, I said to Dickie.
You bet your ass, Lula said. Lula's Limos.
And?
Dickie said.
We don't know anything about starting a business, I said. Do we need some sort of partnership agreement? Do we need a business license? Should we incorporate?
Dickie slid a piece of paper across his desk.
Here are the law firm rates for services.
Wow, I said, looking at the rates. This is a lot of money. I don't know if we can afford you.
Again, lucky me.
I felt my blood pressure edge up a notch. I planted my hands on my hips and glared down at him.
Am I to assume you would rather not have us as clients?
Let me think about that for a nanosecond, Dickie said.
Yes, last time you were in my office, you tried to kill me.
That's an exaggeration. Maim you, yes. Kill you? Probably not.
Let me give you some pre-advice, Dickie said.
Keep your day jobs. The three of you in business will be a disaster, and if you last long enough to go into menopause as business partners, you'll turn into cannibals.
Did I just get insulted? Lula asked.
Okay, so he's a jerk, I said to myself. That doesn't change the mission. You have to keep your eye on the prize. You need to be cordial and find a way to plant the bugs.
Hard to do when Dickie was in his chair behind the desk and I was standing in front of it. You're probably right, I said to Dicky. I looked around and moved to the mahogany shelves that lined one wall. Law books interspersed with personal flotsam. Photographs, awards, a couple carved wood ducks, some art glass. You have a wonderful office, I told him. I went from photograph to photograph. A picture of Dicky with his brother. A picture of Dicky with his parents. A picture of Dicky with his grandparents. A picture of Dicky graduating from college. A picture of Dicky on some ski slope. No pictures of Dicky's ex-wife. I'd inched my way along his wall, and I was now slightly behind him. I cleverly turned to admire the handsome desk set, and that was when I saw it. A picture of Dicky and Joyce Barnhart. Dicky had his arm around Joyce, and they were laughing. And I knew it was recent because Dicky's forehead was unusually high in the photograph. I sucked in some air and told myself to stay calm, but I could feel pressure building in my fingertips, and I worried my scalp might be on fire.
Uh-oh, Lula said, watching me.
Is that Joyce? I asked Dicky.
Yeah, Dicky said. We've reconnected. I had a thing with her a bunch of years ago, and I guess I never got over the attraction.
I know exactly how many years ago. I caught you porking that pig on my dining room table 15 minutes before I filed for divorce, you scum-sucking, dog-fucking lump of goose shit. Joyce Barnhart was a fat, buck-toothed, sneaky little kid who spread rumors, picked at emotional wounds, spit on my dessert at lunchtime, and made my school years a nightmare. By the time she was 20, the fat had all gone to the right places. She dyed her hair red, had her breasts enlarged and her lips plumped, and she set out on her chosen career of homewrecker and gold digger. Looking back on it all, I had to admit Joyce did me a favor by being the catalyst to get me out of my marriage to Dicky. That doesn't alter the fact that Joyce will never be my favorite person.
That's right, Dicky said. Now I remember. I thought I could finish up before you got home, but you came home early.
And next thing, Dicky was on the floor, my hands around his neck. Dicky was yelling as best he could, considering I was choking him and Lula and Connie were in the mix. By the time Lula and Connie wrestled me off Dicky, the room was filled with clerical staff. Dicky dragged himself up and looked at me wild-eyed.
You're all witnesses, he said to the room full of people. She tried to kill me. She's insane. She should be locked up in a loony bin. Call the police. Call animal control. Call my lawyer. I want a restraining order.
You deserve Joyce, I said to Dicky. What you don't deserve is this desk clock. It was a wedding present from my Aunt Tootsie. And I took the clock, turned on my heel, tipped my nose up ever so slightly, and flounced out of his office. Dicky scrambled after me.
Give me that clock. That's my clock.
Lula whipped out her Glock and pointed it at Dicky's nose.
Were you paying attention? Her Aunt Tootsie gave her that clock. Now get your little run ass back in your office and close the door before I put a big hole in your head.
We took the stairs for fear the elevator might be too slow, and we barreled out the front door and speedwalked down the block before the police could show up and haul me off to the clink. I saw the shiny black SUV parked across the street, tinted windows, motor running. I paused and gave the car a thumbs up, and the lights flashed at me. Ranger was listening to the bugs I just left in Dickie's pockets. We rammed ourselves into Lula's Firebird, and Lula rocketed the car away from the curb.
I swear, I thought you were going to burst into flames when you saw that picture of Dickhead and Joyce, Lula said. It was like you had those glowing demon eyes you see in horror movies. I thought your head was going to rotate.
Yeah, but then a calm came over me, I said, and I saw I had a chance to plant the bugs in Dickie's pockets. The calm must have come while you were squeezing his neck and banging his head against the floor, Connie said. I blew out a sigh. Yep, that was about the time. We had food spread all over Connie's desk. Meatball subs and wax paper wrappers, a big tub of coleslaw, potato chips, pickles, and diet sodas. This was a good idea, I said to Lula. I was starved.
Guess going apeshit makes you hungry, Lula said. What's up next?
I thought I'd do some phone work on Simon Diggory. Maybe I can get a lead on him that'll take me someplace other than a graveyard. Diggory was a wiry little guy in his early 50s. His brown hair was shot with gray and tied back in a ponytail. His skin looked like old leather, and he had arms like Popeye from years of hauling dirt. Most often he worked alone, but on occasion he could be seen walking the streets at 2 in the morning with his brother Melvin, shovels on their shoulders like army rifles.
You're not going to get anywhere with phone calls, Lula said. Those Diggories are wily.
I pulled a previous file on Diggory and copied phone numbers and places of employment. In the past, Diggory had delivered pizzas, bagged groceries, pumped gas, and cleaned kennel cages.
It's a place to start, I said to Lula. Better than knocking on their door.
The Diggories all lived together in a raggedy double-wide in Bordentown. Simon, Melvin, Melvin's wife, Melvin's six kids, Melvin's pet python, and Uncle Bill Diggory. If you knocked on the door to the double-wide, you'd only find the python. The Diggories were like feral cats. They scattered into the woods behind their home the minute a car stopped in the driveway. When the weather was especially bad and the ground was frozen, grave robbing was slow work, and Simon would sometimes take odd jobs. I was hoping to catch him at one of those jobs. Since the jobs were random, the only way to learn of them was to trick a family member or neighbor into giving Simon up.
What's the charge this time? Lula asked.
I paged through the file. Drunken disorderly, destruction of private property, attempt at assault. Everyone knew Diggory was Trenton's premier grave robber, but his arrests were seldom associated with desecration of the dead. He was most often arrested for disorderly conduct and assault. When Simon Diggory got drunk, he swung a mean shovel. I gathered my information together and stuffed it into my bag, along with a clock. I'm working at home for the rest of the day.
I feel like working at home until July, Lula said. I'm fed up with this weather.
I'd just gotten into my car when my mom called on my cell.
Where are you? She wanted to know. Are you at the bail bonds office?
I was just leaving.
I was wondering if you would stop at Giovicini's for me on your way home. Your father is out in the taxi all day and my car won't start. I think I need a new battery. I want a half pound of liverwurst, a half pound of ham, a half pound of olive loaf, and a half pound of turkey. Then you can get me some Swiss cheese and some good rye, and a rump roast. And get an Entenmann's. Your grandmother likes the raspberry coffee cake.
Sure, I said. I'm on my way.
The bail bonds office sits with its back to downtown Trenton and its front to a small ethnic neighborhood known as the Berg. I was born and raised in the Berg, and while I now live outside Berg limits, I'm still tethered to it by family and history. Once a burger bit, always a burger bit. Giovicini's is a small family-owned deli a short distance down on Hamilton, and it's the Berg deli of choice. It's also a hotbed of gossip, and I was certain news of my rampage was circulating through every corner of the Berg, including Giovicini's. I was currently driving a burgundy Crown Vic that used to be a cop car. I'd needed a car fast, and this was the only car I could afford at Crazy Iggy's Used Car Emporium. I promised myself the Vic was temporary, put it in gear, and motored to Giovicini's. I hurried through the store, head down, all business, hoping no one would mention Dickie. I walked away from the butcher unscathed, rushed past Mrs. Landau and Mrs. Ruiz without saying hello, and I stood in line at the checkout behind Mrs. Martinelli. Thank goodness she didn't speak English. I looked past Mrs. Martinelli and knew my luck had run out. Lucy Giovicini was at the register.
I hear you trashed your ex's office this morning, Lucy said, checking my groceries. Is it true you threatened to kill him?
No. I was there with Lula and Connie. We had some legal issues we wanted to run by him. Honestly, I don't know how these rumors get started.
And this was only the beginning. I could see it coming. This was going to turn into a disaster of biblical proportions. I carried my bags to the Vic, loaded them into the trunk along with Aunt Tootsie's desk clock, and got behind the wheel. By the time I reached my parents' house, sleet was slanting onto the windshield. I parked in the driveway and dragged the bags to the front door, where my Grandma Mazur was waiting. Grandma Mazur came to live with my parents when my Grandpa Mazur bypassed the FDA and took his trans fat needs to a higher authority.
Did you get the coffee cake?
Grandma asked.
Yep, I got the coffee cake.
I slid past her and carried everything to the kitchen, where my mother was ironing. How long has she been ironing? I asked Grandma.
She's been at it for about 20 minutes, ever since a call came in about you sending Dickie to the hospital and then eluding the police.
My mother ironed when she was stressed. Sometimes she ironed the same shirt for hours.
I didn't send Dickie to the hospital, and there were no police involved.
At least none that I ran across.
Lula and Connie and I went to Dickie for some legal advice, and somehow these rumors got started.
My mother stopped ironing and set the iron on end.
I never hear rumors about Miriam Zawicki's daughter, or Esther Marchese's daughter, or Elaine Rosenbach's daughter. Why are there always rumors about my daughter?
I cut myself a slice of coffee cake, wolfed it down, and crammed my hands into my jeans pockets to keep from eating the whole cake. Grandma was stowing the food in the fridge.
Stephanie and me are just colorful people, so we get talked about a lot. Look at all the crazy things they say about me. I swear, people will say anything.
My mother and I exchanged glances because almost everything crazy that was said about Grandma Mazur was true. If a mortuary viewing was closed casket, she pried the lid open to take a peek. She sneaked out to Chippendale's performances when the roadshow hit town. She drove like a maniac until she finally lost her license. And she punched Morelli's grandma Bella in the nose last year when Bella threatened to put the curse on me. "Would you like a sandwich?" my mother asked. "Can you stay for dinner?"
"Nope, gotta go. I have phone work to do."
Joe Morelli is my off-again, on-again boyfriend. Patience has never been his strong suit, but he's settled into a waiting game while we both struggle with commitment issues. He's 6 feet of hard muscle and Italian libido. His hair is currently longer than he would prefer, more out of laziness than fashion choice. He's a plainclothes Trenton cop who tolerates my job and my association with Ranger, but would prefer I go a safer route, like working as a human cannonball. Morelli owns a little fixer-upper house not far from my parents, but he sleeps over when all the planets are lined up correctly. For almost 2 weeks now, the planets have been misaligned, but it looked like today was about to improve because Morelli's SUV was parked in the lot next to my apartment building. I pulled up next to Morelli's car and cut the Vic's engine. I looked up at my windows and saw that lights were on. I live on the second floor of a no-frills three-story brick building on the edge of Trenton. My unit overlooks the parking lot, and that's fine by me. I can amuse myself watching the seniors smash into each other trying to park. I grabbed my shoulder bag with my failure-to-appear files and hurried into the building. I took the elevator, swung my ass down the second-floor hall, opened the door to my apartment, and stood looking at Morelli. He'd left his boots in my small foyer, and he was at the stove stirring a pot of spaghetti sauce. He was head-to-toe gorgeous male in thick gray socks and a faded Blue Claws t-shirt that hung loose over his jeans. He had a large spoon in one hand and a glass of red wine in the other. His big, goofy orange dog, Bob, was at his feet. Morelli smiled and put the spoon and the glass down when he saw me.
"You're home early," he said. "I thought I'd surprise you with dinner. This feels like a spaghetti night."
Who would have thought Joe Morelli, the scourge of the burg, the bad boy every girl wanted and every mother feared, would grow up and get domesticated? I went to his side and looked into the pot. "Smells wonderful. Do I see hot sausages in there?"
"Yep, from Giovacchini's, and fresh basil and green peppers and oregano. Only a little garlic, since I have big plans for tonight."
My hamster Rex lives in an aquarium on the kitchen counter. Rex likes to snooze in his soup can during the day, but Morelli had fed Rex some green pepper, and Rex was out of his can, busy stuffing the pepper pieces into his cheek. I tapped on the side of the cage by way of saying hello to Rex, and I sipped some of Morelli's wine. "You look good with a spoon in your hand," I said to Morelli.
"I'm gender secure. I can cook, especially if it's man food. I draw the line at folding laundry."
He draped an arm across my shoulders and nuzzled my neck.
"You feel cold, and I'm feeling very warm. I could share some of my heat with you."
"What about the sauce?"
"Needs to simmer for a couple more hours. I don't have that problem. I've been simmering for days."
Chapter 2. I rolled out of bed a little after 8 a.m. and went to the window. Not snowing or sleeting, but not great weather either. Gray skies, and it looked cold. Morelli was gone. He'd caught a double homicide at 10 last night and never returned. Bob had stayed with me, and Bob was now pacing between my bedroom and the front door. I pulled on some sweats, stuffed my feet into my boots, grabbed my coat, and hooked Bob up to his leash.
"Okay, big guy," I said to Bob. "Let's make tracks."
We walked around a couple blocks until Bob was empty, and then we went back to my apartment for breakfast. I made coffee, and while the coffee brewed, Bob and I ate the cold spaghetti. I fed a couple noodles to Rex and gave him fresh water. There was some upheaval in the wood chips in front of Rex's soup can. Rex's nose poked through and did some twitching, and Rex emerged. He scurried to his food dish, packed the noodles into his cheek, and scurried back to his soup can. This is pretty much the extent of my relationship with Rex. Still, he was a heartbeat in the apartment, and I loved him. I carried my coffee into the bathroom and took a long, hot shower. I blasted my hair with a hairdryer and swiped some mascara on my lashes. I got dressed in sweater and jeans and boots, and I took the phone and my paperwork into the dining room. I was working my way through Diggory's neighbors and a second cup of coffee when I heard the lock tumble on my front door. Morelli strolled into the kitchen and poured himself a cup of coffee.
I have news.
Good news or bad news?
Hard to tell, Morelli said. I guess it depends on your point of view. Dickie Orr is missing.
And?
Forced entry on his front door. Blood on the floor. Two bullets extracted from his living room wall. Skid marks on the wood floor in the foyer as if something had been dragged across it.
Get out.
Police responded when his neighbors called saying they heard shots. Chip Berlew and Barrelhead Baker were the first on the scene. They got there a few minutes before midnight. Front door open, no Dickie. And it gets better. Marty Goebel caught the case. And when he talked to Dickie's office first thing this morning, everyone fingered you.
Why would they do that?
Possibly because you went gonzo on him yesterday?
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
What was that about?
Lula and Connie and I wanted to get some legal advice, and I sort of lost it when I saw a picture of Dickie and Joyce Barnhart. He had it on his desk.
I thought you were over, Dickie.
Turns out there was some hostility left.
And now Dickie might be dead, and I wasn't sure what I felt. It seemed mean-spirited to be happy, but I wasn't experiencing a lot of remorse. The best I could manage on short notice was that there would be a hole in my life where Dickie used to reside. But then maybe not. Maybe there wasn't even much of a hole.
Morelli sipped his coffee.
He was wearing a gray sweatshirt under a navy jacket, and his black hair curled over his ears and fell across his forehead. I had a flashback of him in bed when his hair was damp against the nape of his neck, and his eyes were dilated black and focused on me.
Good thing I have an alibi, I said.
And that would be what?
You were here.
I left at 10 to take the murders in the Behringer building.
Uh-oh. Do you think I killed Dickie? I asked Morelli.
No. You were naked and satisfied when I left. I can't see you leaving that mellow state and going off to Dickie's house.
Let me analyze this a little, I said to Morelli. Your expertise in bed is my alibi.
Pretty much.
Do you think that will hold up in a court of law?
No, but it'll look good for me in the tabloids.
And if it wasn't for all that good sex and spaghetti, you'd think I was capable of killing Dickie?
Cupcake, I think you're capable of most anything.
Morelli was grinning, and I knew he was playing with me, but there was some truth in what he was saying as well. I have limits, I told him. He slipped an arm around my waist and kissed my neck.
Fortunately, not too many.
Okay, so probably I should tell Morelli about Ranger and the bugging, but things were going so well, I hated to put a fly in the ointment. If I tell Morelli about the bugging, he'll do his Italian thing, yelling at me and waving his arms and forbidding me to work with Ranger. Then, since I'm of Hungarian descent on my mother's side, I'll have to do my Hungarian thing and glare at him, hands on hips, and tell him I'll work with whoever I damn well want. Then he'll stomp out of my apartment, and I won't see him for a week, during which time we'll both be upset. Are you staying for a while? I asked Morelli.
No, I need to talk to someone in Hamilton Township about the Behringer murders. I was passing by and thought you'd want to know about Dickie.
Morelli looked over my shoulder at the open file.
Diggory again? What's he done this time?
Got drunk and trashed the bar on 9th Street with his shovel, smashed about $2,000 worth of booze and glassware, and chased the bartender down the street.
You aren't spending the night in the cemetery, are you?
Wasn't planning on it. The ground is frozen. Diggory will wait until someone new is planted and the digging is easier. I checked the obits. No one was buried yesterday, and there aren't any funerals today. Is there a specific reason you're interested, or are you just making conversation?
I was thinking about the leftover spaghetti.
Bob and I ate it for breakfast.
In that case, I'll bring dinner,
Morelli said.
Do you have a preference? Chinese, pizza, fried chicken?
Surprise me. Morelli set his cup on the dining room table and kissed the top of my head.
Gotta go. I'll take Bob with me.
And Morelli and Bob were gone. I dialed Lula. I'm not having any luck getting information out of Diggory's relatives. I'm gonna take a ride over there and look around for myself. Do you want to ride along?
Hell no. Last time we were in his shithole trailer, you opened a closet door and a 20-foot snake fell out.
You can stay in the car. That way, if the snake gets me and you don't see me after an hour's gone by, you can call to have someone haul my cold dead body out of the house.
As long as I don't have to get out of the car.
I'll pick you up in a half hour. I gathered my files together, turned my computer off, and called Ranger.
Yo,
Ranger said. Yo yourself. Dickie's disappeared.
That's what I hear.
I have a few questions.
It wouldn't be smart to answer those questions on the phone, Ranger said.
I'm going out with Lula this morning to look for Diggory, but maybe we can get together this afternoon.
Keep your eyes open for the snake.
And Ranger disconnected. I bundled myself up in my big quilted coat, scarf, and gloves, took the elevator to the lobby, and pushed out into the cold. I walked to the Burgundy Crown Vic and gave it a kick to the driver's side door with my boot. I hate you, I said to the car. I got in, cranked the engine over, and drove to the office. Lula came out when I drove up. She wrenched the passenger side door open and looked in at me.
What the heck is this?
A Crown Vic.
I know it's a Crown Vic. Everybody knows a Crown Vic. What are you doing driving one? 3 days ago, you were driving an Escape.
A tree fell on it. It was totaled.
Must have been a big tree.
Are you going to get in?
I'm weighing the consequences. People see me in this, they think I'm arrested again. It's going to be damaging to my good reputation. Even without that, it'll be humiliating. Hard enough being hot without overcoming a humiliating automotive experience. I got an image to think about.
We could use your car.
Yeah, but suppose by some miracle you catch Diggory. I'm not putting his moldy ass in my Firebird.
Well, I'm not driving to Bordentown in this POS all by myself. I'll buy you lunch if you'll get in the car. Lula slid onto the passenger seat and buckled up.
I got a craving for a Cluckburger Deluxe today, and a large fries, and maybe one of them clucky apple pies.
I had $16.57 in my purse, and it had to last me until I brought in a skip and got a new infusion of money. $2.50 for a Cluckburger Deluxe, $1.50 for fries, another dollar for the pie. Then she'd need a drink, and I'd get a bargain meal cheeseburger for 99 cents. That would give me $10 left for an emergency. Good thing Morelli was bringing dinner. I took Hamilton to Broad and headed south. I thought I was hearing a strange grinding sound coming from under the hood, so I turned the radio up.
You're not going to guess what Connie picked up on the police van this morning,
Lula said.
Dickie's missing, and it don't look good. There was blood and bullets all over the place. Hope you got an alibi.
I was with Morelli earlier in the evening.
Don't come much better than that, Lula said.
Did you hear if they have any suspects?
You mean besides you?
Yeah.
Nope. You're it so far as I could tell.
Lula cut her eyes to me.
I don't suppose it was you.
No.
Okay, so it wasn't you directly, but it might have had something to do with the bugs you put on him.
You didn't just say that, and you're never going to say that again, I said to Lula. In fact, yesterday you didn't see or hear anything about bugs.
I must have hallucinated it.
Exactly.
My lips are sealed.
I turned off South Broad and took Route 206 to Groveville. I crossed the railroad tracks and started looking for the road that led to Diggory's house.
This don't look familiar,
Lula said. That's because we were here in the summer last time.
I think it's because we're in the wrong place. You should have map-quested this, Lula said. I always map-quest.
We're not in the wrong place. We just missed a road.
Do you know the name of the road?
No.
See, you needed to map-quest.
A rusted-out pickup blew past us. It had a gun rack across the back window, a Grateful Dead sticker on the bumper, and a rebel flag flying from the antenna. It looked to me like it belonged in Diggory's neighborhood, so I hung a U-turn and kept it in sight, leaving Groveville for a winding two-lane road strewn with potholes.
This looks more like it,
Lula said, watching the countryside fly by.
I remember some of these pathetic excuses for a house.
We passed a shanty constructed of tar paper and particle board, eased around a bend in the road, and Diggory's trailer was to the left, set back about 50 feet. I continued driving until I was out of sight of the trailer. I turned around, cruised past Diggory's again, and parked just beyond the bend. If Diggory saw me parking in front of his house, he'd be halfway to Newark by the time I got out of my car.
I don't think anybody's home, Lula said. I didn't see any cars in the yard.
I'm going to snoop around anyway. Are you coming?
I suppose. But if I see that snake, I'm out of here. I hate snakes. I don't care if that snake wraps itself around your neck. I'm telling you right now, I'm not staying to help.
Diggory lived on a sad patch of parched and frozen hardscrabble. His double-wide trailer had rust stains running from top to bottom, with cankerous rot eating at the trailer floor. The piece of junk was set a foot off the ground on cinder blocks and was held together with black duct tape. Grave robbing obviously didn't pay all that well. There were hardwoods behind the trailer, no leaves at this time of year, just barren, naked stalks of trees. It was late morning, but there was little light filtering through the thick gray cloud cover.
There's a back door on the other side, I said to Lula. You take the back door and I'll take the front door.
The hell I will, Lula said. First off, I don't want no Diggory opening that door and knocking me on my ass trying to get to the woods. And second, well, that's all there is. There's no second. I'm going in behind you so I can be first out if the snake's there.
There was no answer when I knocked on the door, but then I hadn't expected an answer. The little Diggories were in school. The big Diggories were probably picking through dumpsters, looking for lunch. I pushed the door open and cautiously looked inside. I flipped a switch by the door and a 40-watt bulb blinked on in what might pass for the living room. I stepped in and listened for rustling, slithering sounds. Lula stuck her head in and sniffed the air.
I smell snake, she said.
I didn't know what a snake smelled like, but I suspected it was a lot like a Diggory. Snoop around and see if you can find something that tells us where Simon is working, I said to Lula. A pay stub, a matchbook, a map with a big orange X on it.
We should have brought rubber gloves, Lula said. I bet this place is covered with snake spit.
The snake stuff is getting old, I said to her. Could you back off from the snake stuff?
Just trying to be vigilant. If you don't want me reminded you to be careful, hey, okay by me, you're on your own.
Lula opened a closet door, and a mop fell out at her.
Snake! Lula screamed. Snake, snake, snake!
And she ran out of the trailer. I looked out at Lula.
It was a mop.
Are you sure? It looked like a snake to me.
It was a mop.
I think I wet my pants.
Too much information, I said to her.
Lula crept back into the trailer and looked at the mop lying on the floor.
Scared the bejesus out of me, she said.
We made our way through the living room and the kitchen. We looked through a tiny bedroom that was stacked with bunks. We opened the door to the master bedroom, and there it was. The snake. It was curled on the bed, and it was looking at us with lazy snake eyes. It had a lump in its throat that was about the size of the family dog, or maybe a small Diggory. I was paralyzed with fear and horror and gobstopping fascination. My feet wouldn't move, and I could barely breathe.
We're disturbing him, Lula whispered. We should leave now and let him finish his breakfast.
The snake swallowed, and the lump moved 6 inches further down its throat.
Oh, crap,
Lula whispered. And next thing I knew, I was in my car. How did I get in the car? I asked Lula.
You let out a shriek and ran out of the trailer and all the way here. I bet I got footprints on my back where you ran over me.
I slouched in my seat and concentrated on getting my heart to stop racing.
That wasn't a snake. Snakes aren't that big, are they?
It was a snake from hell. It was a motherfucking mutant reptile.
Lula shook her finger at me.
I told you we didn't want to go in there. You wouldn't listen.
I was still shaky enough that I had to two-hand the key to get it in the ignition.
Took me by surprise, I said.
Yeah, me too, Lula said. Do I get my lunch now?
I dropped Lula at the office and looked at my watch. It was a little after one. I had 6 more skips sitting in my bag waiting to get found, but I was having a hard time working up enthusiasm for the whole bounty hunter thing. I decided procrastination was the way to go, so I called Morelli. Is there anything new on Dicky? I asked him.
No, as far as I know, he's still missing. Where are you?
In my car in front of the office, and I'm trying to calm myself. I could hear Morelli smile over the phone line.
How's the snake?
Big.
Did you catch a Diggory?
No, didn't even come close. I disconnected Morelli and called Ranger. Can we talk? I asked him.
Your place or mine?
Yours.
I'm parked behind you.
I looked in my rearview mirror and locked eyes with him. He was in the Porsche Cayenne. Sometimes you freak me out, I said to Ranger.
Babe.
I got out of my garbage scow Crown Vic and into Ranger's shiny, immaculate SUV. You involved me in a murder, I said to Ranger.
And you have no alibi, Ranger said.
Is there anything you don't know?
I don't know what happened to Dicky.
So I guess that means you didn't snatch him.
I don't need bloodstains, Ranger said.
Ranger was dressed in his usual black. Black Vibram-soled boots, black jeans, black shirt, black wool peacoat, and his black Navy SEAL ball cap. Ranger was a shadow, a mystery man, a man who had no time or desire to mix and match colors. Those bugs I planted on Dicky, what was that about? I asked him.
You don't want to know.
Yes, I do.
You don't.
I stared him down.
I do.
Ranger did what for him was a sigh, the barest whisper of expelled breath. I was being a pain in the keister.
I'm looking for a guy named Ziggy Zabar. His brother Zip works for me and came to me for help when Ziggy disappeared last week. Ziggy's a CPA with a firm downtown. They prepare the tax reports for Pediak, Smullen, Gorvich, and Orr. Every Monday, Pediak, Smullen, Gorvich, and Orr hold a partners meeting off-site, and Ziggy Zabar had the meeting on his calendar. He was seen getting into his car to go to the meeting, and then he disappeared. The four partners swear Zabar never showed up, but I don't believe it. There's something not right about the firm. Dickie has legitimate credentials and has passed the Jersey bar. His partners have law degrees from Panama. Right now, I can't tell if Dickie is dumb or dirty.
Did the bugs work?
The meeting was canceled. We listened until a little after 10 and packed up when Dickie went to bed.
So you weren't listening when shots were fired?
No, but I was in his house after the police sealed it, and it looks to me like Dickie left the house wearing the same clothes he had on all day. We tried scanning to pick up a bug, but haven't had any luck. Either he's out of range or the bugs have been found and destroyed.
Now what? Ranger took a little plastic bag from his pocket. It contained another bug.
Do you think you can plant this on Peter Smullen?
I felt my jaw drop and my eyebrows shoot up into my forehead. You're not serious. Ranger took a file off the dashboard and handed it to me.
Smullen wasn't in the office yesterday. He had a dentist appointment, so he shouldn't recognize you. Here are a couple pictures of Smullen, a short bio, plus our best guess at what his schedule will be like tomorrow. He divides his time between Trenton and Bogota. When he's in town, he's a creature of habit, so running into him won't be a problem. Try to tag him tomorrow morning so I can listen to him all day.
And I'm gonna do this why?
I'll let you wrestle with that one,
Ranger said. He looked through the Cayenne windshield at my car.
Is there a reason you're driving the Vic?
It was cheap.
Babe, free wouldn't be cheap enough.
You haven't asked me if I killed Dickie, I said to Ranger.
I know you didn't kill Dickie. You never left your apartment.
There was a time when I considered Ranger's surveillance an invasion of privacy, but that time was long gone. There's not much point to worrying about things you can't control, and I had no control over Ranger. Where is it? On my car? I asked him, doing a pretty decent job of not sounding completely pissed off. His mouth didn't smile, but his eyes crinkled a little at the corners.
GPS unit in your bag, please don't remove it.
I took the file and the bug in a bag and got out of the Cayenne. I imagine you'll be watching my every move.
Just like always, Ranger said.
I got into the Crown Vic, cranked the engine over, and turned the heat on full blast. I looked in my rearview mirror. No Ranger. I studied the pictures of Peter Smullen. He was an average-looking guy with receding brown hair and a beer belly, heavy 5 o'clock shadow in all the photos, lips like a flounder. His file put him at 5'8", 46 years old, married with two kids, ages 20 and 22. Both kids and the wife were in Colombia. Smullen kept a bachelor apartment in Hamilton Township. When Smullen was in town, at precisely 8 o'clock, he'd roll into a parking garage that was a block from his office at the law firm and get a triple shot frappuccino at the Starbucks on the corner. I'd get him at the Starbucks. I closed the file, turned to lay it on the seat next to me, and the Vic's driver's side door was suddenly wrenched open. Joyce Barnhart glared in at me and called me the C-word. Joyce was 6 foot tall in 4-inch spike-heeled black boots. She was wearing a black leather duster lined with fake fur. Her eyes were enhanced with rhinestone-studded fake eyelashes. Her red enameled nails were long and frightening. The package was topped with a lot of shoulder-length brilliant red hair arranged in curls and waves. Joyce had never moved beyond Farrah Fawcett. I narrowed my eyes at her. Is there a point to this conversation?
You killed him. You found out we were a couple and you couldn't handle it, so you killed him.
I didn't kill him.
I was inches from marrying the little turd, and you ruined it all. Do you have any idea how much he's worth? A fucking fortune. And you killed him, and now I get nothing. I hate you.
I turned the key in the ignition and put the Vic into drive. I have to go now, I said to Joyce. Good talk.
I'm not done, Joyce said. I'm just beginning. I'm gonna get even. I'm gonna make your life a misery.
Joyce pulled a gun out of her coat pocket and aimed it at me.
I'm gonna shoot out your eye, and then I'm gonna shoot you in the foot and the knee and the ass.
I stomped on the gas pedal and rocketed off with my door still open. Joyce squeezed off two rounds, putting a hole in the rear window. I looked in my mirror and got a glimpse of her standing in the middle of the road, giving me the finger. Joyce Barnhart was nuts. I drove one block down Hamilton and turned into the burg. I was thinking after the traumatic Joyce experience, I needed something to calm myself, like a piece of the raspberry Entenmann's. Plus, my dad had all kinds of things stashed in his cellar, like electrician's tape that I could use to patch my rear window. Wind was whistling through the bullet hole, creating a draft on the back of my neck. It would have been perfectly okay in July, but it was damn cold in February. I wound through the maze of Berg streets to my parents' house and parked in the driveway. I got out and examined the car. Hole in the rear window, and Joyce took out a brake light. I hunched against the sleet and ran to the front door. I let myself in, dropped my bag on the sideboard in the foyer, and went to the kitchen. My mother was at the sink washing vegetables. Grandma was at the little table with a cup of tea. The Entenmann's box was on the small kitchen table. I held my breath and approached the box. I flipped the lid. Two pieces left. I anxiously looked around. "Anyone want this Entenmann's?" I asked. "Not me," Grandma said. "Not me either," my mother said. I shrugged out of my jacket, hung it on the back of the chair, and sat down. "Anything new in the world of crime?" Grandma asked. Same old," I told her. "What's new with you?" "I'm out of that glue stuff for my dentures. I was hoping you could run me out to the drugstore." "Sure." I wolfed down the last of the cake and scraped back in my chair. "I can take you now, but then I need to get back to work." "I'll just go upstairs and get my purse," Grandma said. I leaned toward her and lowered my voice. "No gun." Grandma Mazur carries a .45 long barrel named Elsie. It wasn't registered, and she didn't have a permit to carry concealed. Grandma thought being old gave her license to pack. She called it the equalizer. My mother kept taking the gun away, and the gun kept mysteriously returning.
"I don't know what you're talking about," Grandma said. "I've got enough problems with the police right now. I can't afford to get pulled over for a broken taillight and have them discover you're armed and dangerous."
"I never go anywhere without Elsie," Grandma said.
"What's all the whispering about?" my mother wanted to know.
"We were trying to decide if I needed to put on some fresh lipstick," Grandma said.
I looked over at her.
"You don't need lipstick. A woman always needs lipstick. Your lipstick is fine." "You're getting to be just like your mother," Grandma said.
There was a time when that statement would have freaked me out, but now I was thinking maybe it wouldn't be so bad to have some of my mother's qualities. She was a stabilizing influence on the family. She was the representative of accepted social behavior. She was the guardian of our health and security. She was the bran muffin that allowed us to be jelly donuts. Grandma and I were at the front door, and I remembered the hole in the windshield. "Duct tape," I called to my mother. "Where would I find it, the garage or the cellar?" My mother came with a roll. "I keep some in the kitchen. Are you fixing something?"
"I have a hole in my back window."
Grandma Mazur squinted at the vic.
"Looks like a bullet hole."
"Dear God," my mother said. "It's not a bullet hole, is it?"
"No," I told her, "absolutely not."
Grandma Mazur buttoned herself into her long royal blue wool coat. She buckled a little under the weight, but managed to right herself and get to the car.
"Isn't this the kind of car the cops use?" she asked.
"Yes."
"Does it have one of them flashing lights?"
"No."
"Bummer," Grandma said.
Chapter 3. I followed Grandma up and down the aisles, past personal products to Metamucil, hemorrhoid remedies, hairspray, harlequin romances, greeting cards. She got her denture glue and moved to lipsticks. A gap-toothed red-headed kid rounded a corner and came to a stop in front of us.
"Hi,"
he yelled. He was followed by Cynthia Hauser. Cynthia and I had been classmates. She was married now to a gap-toothed red-headed guy who fathered three gap-toothed red-headed kids. They lived a block over from Morelli in a little duplex that had more toys than grass in the front yard.
"This is Jeremy,"
Cynthia said to Grandma and me. Jeremy had trouble written all over him. Jeremy just about vibrated with energy.
"What a cute little boy," Grandma said. "I bet you're real smart."
"I'm too smart for my britches," Jeremy said. "That's what most people tell me."
An old man shuffled up and looked us over. He was wearing a wavy jet black toupee that sat slightly askew on his bald dome. He had bushy, out-of-control eyebrows, a lot of ear hair, and even more slack skin than Grandma. I thought he looked to be on the far side of 80.
"What's going on here?"
he asked.
"This is Uncle Elmer," Cynthia said. "There was a fire in his apartment at assisted living, so he came to live with us."
"It wasn't my fault," Uncle Elmer said.
"You were smoking in bed," Jeremy said. "It's lucky you didn't cream yourself."
Cynthia grimaced.
"You mean cremate."
Uncle Elmer grinned at Grandma.
"Who's this sexy young thing?"
"Aren't you the one?" Grandma said to Elmer. Elmer winked at her.
"The boys at the home would love you. You look hot."
"It's the coat," Grandma said. "It's wool."
Elmer fingered the coat.
"Looks like good quality. I was in retail, you know. I can tell quality."
"I've had it for a while," Grandma said. "I was taller when I first bought it. I've shrunk up some."
Elmer gave his head a small shake, and the toupee slid over one ear. Elmer reached up and righted it.
"The golden years are a bitch,"
Elmer said.
"You don't look like you shrunk much," Grandma said. "You're a pretty big guy."
"Well, some of me shrunk and some of me swollen up,"
Elmer said.
"When I was young, I got a lot of tattoos and now they don't look so good. One time I got drunk and got Eisenhower tattooed on my balls, but now he looks like Orville Redenbacher."
"He makes good popcorn," Grandma said.
"You bet, and don't worry, I still got it where it counts."
"Where's that?" Grandma asked.
"In the sack. Hangs a little lower than it used to, but the equipment still works, if you know what I mean."
"Uncle Elmer poops in a bag," Jeremy said.
"It's temporary," Elmer said, "just till the bypass heals up. They put some pig intestine in me on an experimental basis."
"Gee," I said, "look at the time. We have to be running along now."
"Yeah, I can't be late for dinner tonight," Grandma said. "I want to make the early viewing at the funeral parlor. Milton Busick is laid out, and I hear you wouldn't even recognize him."
"You got a good funeral parlor here?"
Elmer asked Grandma.
"I go to the one on Hamilton Avenue. It's run by two real nice young men, and they serve homemade cookies."
"I wouldn't mind some homemade cookies," Elmer said. "I could meet you there tonight. I am looking for a lady friend, you know. Do you put out?"
Cynthia smacked Uncle Elmer on the head.
"Behave yourself."
"I haven't got time,"
Elmer said, readjusting his hair. "I gotta
know these things."
"Now what?" I asked Grandma Mazur when we settled ourselves into the car.
"I gotta go home so I can get ready for tonight. That Elmer is a frisky one. He'll get